From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Former Ukraine Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch is testifying today in the second day of public impeachment inquiry hearings about why she was pushed out of her post, she believes, in a back-channel campaign by President Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, and his Ukrainian cohorts.
Working together, they apparently succeeded in orchestrating the removal of a U.S. ambassador. How could our system fail like this? How is it that foreign corrupt interests could manipulate our government? Which country's interests are served when the very corrupt behavior we have been criticizing is allowed to prevail?
Later today, behind closed doors, House lawmakers will take testimony from the diplomatic aide who overheard a phone conversation in which President Trump is said to have discussed investigations of political rivals that he wanted Ukraine to conduct. Let's bring in our Friday politics roundtable. Rick Klein, political director at ABC News, and Jesse Holland, host at C-SPAN's Washington Journal. Welcome to both of you. And Rick, let me start with you on something else that has happened today. Pretty big news. A federal jury in Washington has found that Trump advisor Roger Stone is guilty on all counts in his trial. He was charged with lying to Congress, witness tampering. This is a case that grew out of special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. What do you make of this? Roger Stone was under scrutiny for his contacts with WikiLeaks and the release in the 2016 election of hacked Democratic Party emails.
And Roger Stone is someone who's known President Trump for 40 years, in some ways was a founding father of the presidential campaign, was someone consulted early on. And in particular, he's convicted of lying about the contacts that he had with WikiLeaks during the campaign. So extremely relevant to all of the proceedings that came out during the Mueller investigation. Stone was defiant throughout, and now he's found guilty of all of these charges, seven charges in all, lying to Congress, obstructing an investigation, and in one case, trying to influence someone else's testimony. Pretty startling development that's going to leave Roger Stone in prison for what could be the rest of his life.
Wow. Of course, Trump could pardon him, right?
That's right. These are federal charges. And I've talked to people around Stone who believe that that's a possibility. But of course, that is a political minefield of its own. We'll have to see how the president reacts to this news. But this is yet another associate of President Trump, someone involved in his campaign, involved in his orbit for a very long time, who is now stands as a convicted federal felon.
Rick and Jesse, let's talk a little bit about what's happening as we speak, the impeachment inquiry hearings. Jesse, President Trump tweeted this morning that everywhere Marie Yovanovitch went turned bad. Democrats are already calling that witness intimidation, that tweet. Rick and Jesse, did the president step in it? I'll start with you, Jesse.
Well, if there's one question that's been answered this morning is that the president is not controlled by his lawyers, because no self-respecting lawyer would let anyone in a trial talk about a witness as the witness is testifying. It's just amazing to see that tweet come out while the ambassador is talking and testifying in front of Congress. So it's very, very weird to have something like that happen. And President Trump has stepped really close to that line. If this actually was a court, it would be almost no doubt that the judge would have the President Trump under contempt right now for talking about a witness as a witness is testifying in front of the Congress.
Yeah. Rick, your thoughts on this?
I think strategically it's a pretty tone-deaf thing for the president to do if there was a strategy in mind here. What he gave this story was something new, something fresh, something really pretty galling. When you heard Ambassador Yovanovitch talk about her background, the intimidation that she felt, the fact that she felt that she was being targeted by Rudy Giuliani and corrupt Ukrainian influences, only to have her integrity questioned, her service questioned, some suggestion by President Trump that she was responsible somehow for the situation in Somalia in the 1990s, it's outlandish. And it was called out by Democrats in real time, and I think gave today's hearings an additional piece of urgency, which is not what President Trump needed.
Well, and the Democrats have started to move away from talking about impeaching for high crimes and misdemeanors to impeaching for bribery. This is House Speaker Nancy Pelosi yesterday using that word bribery, as a few other senior Democrats have done.
Well, you know, we're talking Latin around here, in pluribus unum, from anyone, from anyone. Quid pro quo, bribery, and that is in the Constitution attached to the impeachment proceedings.
Jesse, does this change of focus from quid pro quo to bribery bolster the argument for impeachment?
Well, with bribery, you don't actually have to be successful. One of the arguments Republicans have made is that Ukraine didn't actually get anything. They were going to get the funding anyway, so they didn't actually get anything. But with bribery, you don't have to actually get something. You only have to make the attempt to ask for it. And so they feel that that's an easier case to prove with everything that they've had, with all of the testimony they have. They feel bribery is a easier and, honestly, more understandable charge than quid pro quo for Americans. Because in addition to this being a congressional proceeding, this is also going on in the court of public opinion. And I think they believe that bribery is much more understandable than the quid pro quo for most Americans.
Rick, what's your sense of the timing at this point of how this is going to proceed? We've got Thanksgiving coming up in just a couple of weeks, less than 2 weeks from today. And then, you know, the holiday season, and then maybe a trial in the Senate in January. Is that your sense?
The Democrats are going to have a series of witnesses on Capitol Hill next week in public testimony that includes Colonel Vindman from the National Security Council, which should be pretty compelling. And I think their hope is to cram in as much of this work as possible before the holidays. The goal remains, is my understanding, to have a vote on articles of impeachment potentially right before Christmas, teeing up the Senate to take this over in January, February. Of course, that's in the middle of Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primaries and the primary voting season, which is not comfortable news to the half dozen or so senators running for president. But those are the facts. And I think this is probably something that's going to get worked out against that backdrop of primary voting.
Yeah, there were also a couple of other things that happened over the last few days. Let's talk a little bit about Trump's tax returns. Yesterday, the White House appealed to the Supreme Court to block President Trump's accounting firm from having to turn over 8 years of his tax returns to prosecutors in New York. Jesse, Trump's lawyers argue that the president is immune from all criminal proceedings while in office. What do you believe is at stake here?
Well, there's nothing at stake here other than the separation of powers. Mm-hmm. Can the president be investigated by Congress? This is something that the third branch of our government, the Supreme Court, will have to decide. These same arguments were made by President Nixon and President Clinton during the investigations against them. Now President Trump is making the same argument that Congress is going too far in investigating the executive branch and him personally. What the Supreme Court decides on this case will shape the relationship between Congress, the Supreme Court, and the president from now on. So this is one of the more important Supreme Court decisions that's going to come out in the future.
Yeah, I'm wondering, too, about public opinion. You know, with so much happening over the last few years, these tax returns, is there still a yearning from the general public to see these returns? Both of you, Rick, what are your thoughts on that?
I haven't seen recent polling on it. I know that the president repeatedly promised that he would provide full transparency on his tax returns. He has reneged on that promise. He has backed off of it and I think falsely suggested it's only because he's under audit that he hasn't released it. Every president in modern times since Nixon has released his or her taxes. That's the only way to really understand the full finances. And I do think for the public tuning into impeachment, tuning into all of these, there's an accumulation of information that can be wearying at times, but it just adds up to certain impressions. And the impression of a president that does not want to be closely scrutinized, to Jesse's point, I think is a very real one.
Let's just talk politics in the last couple of minutes that we have here. I guess we've been talking politics the whole time, but let's talk a little bit of different politics. People running for election. There is a runoff in Louisiana tomorrow in the governor's race. This is incumbent Democrat John Bel Edwards up against Eddie Rasponi. Jesse, will the results in Louisiana give us any indication of the mood among the electorate right now?
Well, one of the things that we'll be able to tell from Louisiana is whether President Trump still has the power to push Republican candidates over the top. Now, keep in mind, President Trump went down to Kentucky at the last moment and tried to help the Republican candidates there at the last second, and it did not help. President Trump also went to Louisiana at the last second to try to help the Republican candidate. If the Republican does not win in Louisiana, that will start the narrative that President Trump does not help Republicans anymore, and that will have a great effect on the 2020 elections.
Okay, and that brings us to the 2020 elections. And Rick, the last question to you. Deval Patrick, in the race now for president, I think there are 17 or something Democrats running for president. Is he a big threat to Biden or Warren or Buttigieg, or what do you think?
this is the time where usually the field contracts. Somehow it's still expanding. I think he, to the extent that he's a threat, it is he's aiming at the left in his messaging, but really this is a candidate of the center. And I think Joe Biden and particularly Pete Buttigieg have to worry about what Deval Patrick's message means. He's often described as Obama-esque. He's a longtime friend of President Obama since before he was in office. And I think he has the capacity, the ability to get crowds and supporters engaged in that way. The question, can you do it as late as he has? He has to raise a lot of money very quickly. This thing's been going on for a year already.
Mm-hmm. Rick Klein is political director at ABC, and Jesse Holland is a host at C-SPAN's Washington Journal. Thank you so much for this political roundtable. This is Here
Thank
Now.
You.
This week, astronomers gathered at Mercury Bay in New Zealand to observe the transit of Mercury across the face of the sun. Mercury Bay got its name from the explorer, Captain James Cook, who saw the transit of Mercury there 250 years ago. Cook was in the South Pacific on a mission from the British Admiralty to search for a lost continent known as Terra Australis. It was the first of 3 years-long voyages that Cook took around the world. When all was said and done, he was dead on a beach in Hawaii, but his legacy endures as one of the greatest explorers in human history. Cliff Thornton is a member of the Captain Cook Society who knows more about Captain Cook than just about anybody. I spoke with Thornton earlier this year, and he said Cook helped draw the map of the world that we know today.
When he started out, that the Pacific Ocean was really a blank canvas. By the time he'd finished, that there were islands here, there, and everywhere that he'd mapped and often drawn detailed charts for them.
And it took a long time in those days to get from the British Isles out to the South Pacific. There was no Panama Canal to go through.
There was no Panama Canal, and he was sailing in what was called a North Sea collier. It had been built not for the Navy, it had been built for the coal trade. It was a snub-nosed thing. You were lucky if you could get 8 knots out of it.
Hmm. And so how long did it take to get from the UK out to, let's say, New Zealand?
Well, let's take Tahiti on that first voyage. It would be about 6 months.
Wow.
Not in one go. They stopped en route at various places, but the sailing time was easily 6 months.
And when you say they stopped en route, and especially when they stopped in some of these islands like Tahiti, like Tonga, like other places in the South Pacific, they encountered people there. So how did they interact? How did Captain Cook and his men interact with the people on the islands?
Well, the first place he went to was Tahiti, and he was fortunate there because a Polynesian priest came to him and said, look, I'd really like to travel with you. I know all this area. I can tell you where the islands are. I can help you navigate there, and I can help translate. His name was Tupaia, and he was worth his weight in gold. I don't think Cook could have achieved what he did if it hadn't been for Tupaia. Whenever he got to a new island, he would lead Cook ashore. He would say, sit on the sand, take your shirt off. I'm just going to make a speech. And Tupaia made the speech to the local chief and established peaceful relations, and it went from there.
Well, and how did Captain Cook reflect on his role as an outsider or a colonizer? It seems like he was a little hesitant about the impact that the European perspective would have on some of these cultures.
I wouldn't call him a colonizer. He was a visitor, and he was a regular visitor at some of the places, like New Zealand. He was there for every one of his 3 voyages. Mm-hmm. And the benefit of that was that he could see how the people changed from his first visit in 1769, 1773, I think, and then 1777. And it wasn't a good change. And if there was one impact that had on all of the people, it was they discovered that the British had iron. There's no natural source of iron in any of the Pacific Islands. It was almost a Stone Age existence. If you wanted to cut something, you used a sharpened stone or you used an edge of a shell. And so to actually say, look, here's this metal that you can sharpen, you can get a blade on. And so by this last visit, Cook actually recorded in his journal that the people had become more greedy for the metal. They wanted it so much, they would prostitute their wives or their daughters just to get some metal off the sailors. And they were thieving from each other, stuff that had never existed before. And so Cook saw that, and he was disappointed that what he thought he would bring as benefit to the islanders was actually leading to a deterioration.
Well, the reason that we know all of this about him is because he kept these meticulous notes along his journey every single day, writing in his journal. What kind of thoughts did he write down about what he was thinking?
He wrote down the day-to-day events, and then whenever he had finished a visit to an island, to a people's, he would summarize at quite length the description of the peoples, how they dressed, what they spoke, a glossary of their words sometimes, and a description of the land, whether it was rocky, whether the soil was good, whether it would support crops. And then he wrote down about the demeanor of the people. And as he went around the Pacific, he met people in vastly different stages of what you would say civilization, for want of a better word. In Tahiti, you had a social hierarchy, but the people lived in pretty plain huts and a pretty simple lifestyle. When he got to New Zealand, there was a far more structured social positions. Mm-hmm. They lived in large houses with these highly decorated fascias to them, and so they were far more advanced compared to Tahiti. Then he came to Australia and found the Aborigines leading almost a nomadic existence, surviving under pieces of bark for shelter. And at first sight, here, let me read what he wrote, because it's hard to believe that he wrote this. This is about the Aborigines in Australia. The natives appear to be the most wretched people upon earth. But in reality, they are far more happier than we Europeans, being wholly unacquainted not only with the superfluous, but the necessary conveniences so much sought after in Europe. They are happy in not knowing the use of them. They live in tranquility, which is not disturbed by the inequality of condition. They set no value upon anything we gave them, and nor would they ever part with anything of their own. This was a 42-year-old sailor. He speaks like a sociologist.
Right. Well, he's certainly seen enough people at this point in his life to have that background.
There was a sort of empathy coming across in there as well. He comes across as very much a humanitarian, and it hurts me so much when a lot of the indigenous peoples today are throwing sticks and stones verbally at Cook.
So Cook's legacy today is complicated. How do people regard the places that he discovered for the British, the monuments to him? Some of them have been vandalized over the years.
Well, if you ask me what his legacy is, it would be a different story to if you asked an indigenous, let's say Maori or somebody from Hawaii. But as you are asking me, then I think that his legacy is the map of the Pacific. I remember there was a French explorer who was going to go out, and somebody said, well, what are you going to do? And he said, I don't know. Cook's done it all. There's nothing left for me to find, I don't think. A common thing that's in England today is tattooing has become very, very popular. It was Cook's voyages that brought tattooing back to the UK. Mm-hmm. They were, the sailors were tattooed out in Tahiti and places around there and brought them back and said, hey, look what I've got. And now look what's happened. It's everywhere.
Let's talk about how Captain Cook died. He died in Hawaii. He was killed in Hawaii. What happened?
Well, it's a long, sad story. He'd had a successful visit to Hawaii, and he set off to continue north to the Bering Strait again, but the ship sprung a mast, and he had to return. He came back to Kealakekua Bay, which was where he'd been before. It said that he'd come back at a different series when a different god was in favor. Okay, he could live with that, but he didn't like them stealing one of the ship's cutters. So he invited a local chief to come on board, and the chief was walking along the coast to get on his boat. And the people said, don't go, chief, don't go. And the chief sat down, and people came from the other side of the bay and said, look, bad things are happening. Don't go with this man. They formed up along the beach, and suddenly a hail of stones came over from the people, and Cook fired one of the barrels. He had a double-barrel blunderbuss type thing. Mm-hmm. It had small shot in. It didn't have anything. The small shot just bounced
just
off the Cape.
A little bit.
Bounced off the Cape. This man thought, hey, he's shot and I'm not being killed. And it just emboldened them. And I'm afraid they attacked the shore party. The Marines fired, but you know how long it takes to reload one of those long muskets. They were all over them and they just ran for their lives to the boats. And of course, Cook, he was left on the beach and he was attacked and he was drowned there. Yeah.
So the reason that we are talking about this right now is because the author Tony Horowitz just recently passed away suddenly, and he had written this incredible book with your help about Captain Cook. You're one of the subjects in the book.
Oh, I just have a walk-on roll.
Walk-on roll. Well, you're in there for at least 100 pages. But anyway, he went and retraced the steps of Captain Cook.
Yes, he certainly did.
Well, let's just talk about Tony Horowitz for a minute. What was it like to work with him?
It was an honor and a privilege, and I didn't realize it at the time. But that man was I would call him a literary alchemist. He took what I thought were ordinary events of the day, things that were made of lead. But when you read about them in his book, he turned them into burnished gold. I'm thinking, well, I was there, I saw that, but I never saw it through the eyes that Tony had, to make it so readable. I once had the privilege of having a peek in his study, and the bookcase was absolutely full of the best, the most academic books about Cook. That man's had such a knowledge about Cook.
Well, and I would recommend that any of our listeners go and read this book, Blue Latitudes, Boldly Going Where Captain Cook Has Gone Before, because it is really fascinating. That is Cliff Thornton, who is a member of the Captain Cook Society. Thank you so much for joining us and remembering Captain Cook.
A real pleasure, Jeremy. Thank you.
And you can listen to our full conversation at hereandnow.org, where we've also got a map of Captain Cook's voyages. 'Cause baby, now we got bad blood. You know it used to be mad love. So take a look what you've done. 'Cause baby, now we got bad blood.
Many Taylor Swift fans know that the singer has had bad blood with her former record company, Big Machine Records, for quite some time. But late last night, the feud took a new turn when Swift accused Big Machine Records of blocking her from singing her old music at the upcoming American Music Awards. At the heart of the issue, artists' master rights. For more, let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hey, Mike.
Hi, Tanya.
So tell us first, what is Swift alleging?
Well, basically what she's saying is that since Big Machine's label owns the master recordings, as you said, of her first six albums, they're basically using that as leverage to prevent her from actually just performing the old songs in a medley of her music at an upcoming American Music Awards show. They want to honor her as what they call the artist of the decade. So naturally, she wants to perform some of those older songs. And she's also saying that they are preventing Netflix from using the older music and even video of her performing the songs in an upcoming documentary that Netflix is working on about her life. So they're basically trying to leverage that ownership of the recordings to prevent her from performing them and also from using them in this Netflix documentary.
Okay. And Big Machine Records actually put out a statement. They don't deny that they're denying her her rights to sing the old songs at the AMA or for Netflix doc, but they do say that she owes them millions. I want to talk a little bit about this larger issue. A lot of Swift supporters are casting this as a feminist issue, saying she's up against two male record execs who Swift calls bullies. And after all, she's the one who wrote and performed these songs. But then there's the issue of her contract. Does she, in fact, legally own the rights to these songs because she wrote them?
Well, so there's two basic ways you can get royalties from a song. One is owning the actual master recordings, which the record label does in this case. So they literally own the tapes that were made in the studio of these songs. And then all copies of the song, whether it's on a CD or a digital file that's streamed, come from those tapes. The songwriting ownership, what's known as the publishing rights, is something completely separate. That's actually the melody of the song, the chords and the words. They do not own that. But the contract between the two apparently is very complicated. And what the big machines label is saying is that if she were to perform these on TV, that would amount to a new recording of the songs, which she's not allowed to do in her contract until next year. And timing is everything in it with this, because this show that she wants to perform them on is at the end of November, and it's honoring her as an artist of the decade. So obviously she wants to play those old songs, and she wants to play them this year, which she, according to this contract, she's not really allowed to do.
Yeah, yeah. You know, this is something that many artists deal with. Back in 2009, musical artists got together and formed a group advising artists to make certain their contracts are also allowing them artists control and maintaining control of their master recording. So this is something we'll definitely be following in the long haul. Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's Here and Now.
Do you swear or affirm that the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? Let the record show that the witness has answered in the affirmative. Thank you, and please be seated.
Former Ambassador to Ukraine Marie Yovanovitch being sworn in this morning. She's testifying in the second day of public impeachment hearings before the committee, which is looking into whether President Trump abused his power by asking Ukraine to investigate his political rival, Joe Biden. Yovanovitch factors into the inquiry because she was abruptly recalled from her post in May. Her boss told her she had done nothing wrong, but that the president had lost confidence in her. She says she was the victim of a smear campaign. Other witnesses have said the same. And today, she described her record before she was removed.
During my tenure in Ukraine, I went to the front line approximately 10 times during a hot war to show the American flag, to hear what was going on, sometimes literally as we heard the impact of artillery, and to see how our assistance dollars were being put to use. I worked to advance U.S. policy, fully embraced by Democrats and Republicans alike, to help Ukraine become a stable and independent democratic state with a market economy integrated into Europe. A secure, democratic, and free Ukraine serves not just the Ukrainian people, but the American people as well. That's why it was our policy, continues to be our policy, to help the Ukrainians achieve their objectives. They match our objectives. The U.S. is the most powerful country in the history of the world, in large part because of our values. And our values have made possible the network of alliances and partnerships that buttresses our own strength. Ukraine, with an enormous landmass and a large population, has the potential to be a significant commercial and political partner for the United States, as well as a force multiplier on the security side. We see the potential in Ukraine. Russia sees, by contrast, sees the risk. The history is not written yet, but Ukraine could move out of Russia's orbit. And now, Ukraine is a battleground for great power competition, with a hot war for the control of territory and a hybrid war to control Ukraine's leadership. The U.S. has provided significant security assistance since the onset of the war against Russia in 2014. And the Trump administration strengthened our policy by approving the provision to Ukraine of anti-tank missiles known as Javelins. Supporting Ukraine is the right thing to do. It's also the smart thing to do. If Russia prevails and Ukraine falls to Russian dominion, we can expect to see other attempts by Russia to expand its territory and its influence.
Chairman Adam Schiff also asked Yovanovitch today about losing her post and whether the State Department tried to intervene during what they called the smear campaign against her.
In the face of this smear campaign, did colleagues at the State Department try to get a statement of support for you from Secretary Pompeo?
Yes.
Were they successful?
No.
Did you come to learn that they couldn't issue such a statement because they feared it would be undercut by the president?
Yes.
And then were you told that though you had done nothing wrong, you did not enjoy the confidence of the president and could no longer serve as ambassador?
Yes, that is correct.
And in fact, you flew home from Kiev on the same day as the inauguration of Ukraine's new president?
That's true.
That inauguration was attended by three who have become known as the Three Amigos, Ambassadors Sondland, Volker, and Perry, was it?
Yes.
And 3 days after that inauguration, in a meeting with President Trump, are you aware that the president designated these three amigos to coordinate Ukraine policy with Rudy Giuliani?
Since then, I've become aware of that.
This is the same Rudy Giuliani who orchestrated the smear campaign against you?
Yes.
And the same Rudy Giuliani who, during the now infamous July 25th phone call, the president recommended to Zelensky in the context of the two investigations the president wanted into the 2016 election and the Bidens?
Yes.
And finally, Ambassador, in that July 25th phone call, the president praises one of these corrupt former Ukrainian prosecutors and says they were treated very unfairly. They were treated unfairly. Not you, who was smeared and recalled, but one of them. What message does that send to your colleagues in the U.S. Embassy in Kiev?
I'm just not sure what the basis for that kind of a statement would be. Certainly not from our reporting over years.
Did you have concern, though, or do you have concern today about what message the president's action sends to the people who are still in Ukraine representing the United States when a well-respected ambassador can be smeared out of her post with the participation and acquiescence of the President of the United States?
Well, it's, I think, been a big hit for morale, both at U.S. Embassy Kyiv, but also more broadly in the State Department.
Is it fair to say that other ambassadors and others of lesser rank who serve the United States and embassies around the world might look at this and think, if I take on corrupt people in these countries, that could happen to me?
I think that's a fair statement, yes.
Republicans are using today's hearing to criticize Democrats for holding the impeachment inquiry at all. Here is ranking committee member Republican Devin Nunes.
It's unfortunate that today and for most of next week, we will continue engaging in the Democrats' day-long TV spectacles instead of solving the problems we were all sent to Washington to address. We now have a major trade agreement with Canada and Mexico ready for approval, a deal that would create jobs and boost our economy. Meanwhile, we have not yet approved funding for the government, which expires next week, along with funding for our men and women in uniform. Instead, the Democrats have convened us once again to advance their operation to topple a duly elected president. I'll note that five Democrats on this committee had already voted to impeach this president before the Trump-Zelensky phone call occurred. In fact, Democrats have been vowing to oust President Trump since the day he was elected. So Americans can rightly suspect that his phone call with President Zelensky was used as an excuse for the Democrats to fulfill their Watergate fantasies.
Well, during Yovanovitch's testimony, President Trump sent out a tweet attacking her. He said everywhere Yovanovitch went turned bad. She disagreed and said she felt things were improving.
Ukraine, for example, where there are huge challenges, including, you know, on the issue that we're discussing today of corruption. Huge challenges. But they've made a lot of progress since 2014, including in the years that I was there. And I think in part, the Ukrainian people get the most credit for that. But a part of that credit goes to the work of the United States and to me as the ambassador in Ukraine.
Ambassador, you've shown the courage to come forward today and testify, notwithstanding the fact you were urged by the White House or State Department not to. Notwithstanding the fact that, as you testified earlier, the president implicitly threatened you in that call record, and now the president in real time is attacking you, what effect do you think that has on other witnesses' willingness to come forward and expose wrongdoing.
Well, it's very intimidating.
It's designed to intimidate, is it not?
I mean, I can't speak to what the president is trying to do, but I think the effect is to be intimidating.
Well, I want to let you know, Ambassador, that some of us here take witness intimidation very, very seriously.
Some sound from today's impeachment hearings.
Our next story involves a precious violin and a name that may be familiar to NPR listeners. Virtuoso Roman Totenberg's rare Stradivarius was stolen in 1980. Decades later, the violin was recovered, and tonight it's returning to the scene of the crime in Cambridge, Massachusetts, for a homecoming performance. Andrea Shea from member station WBUR has more on the violin's journey back to where it disappeared.
For nearly four decades, Roman Totenberg and his Stradivarius, which was crafted in 1734, danced on major orchestra stages around the world. But Totenberg's intimate relationship with his rare instrument came to a shocking end.
In 1980, my father, who was then also the head of the Longy School of Music in Cambridge, played a recital there.
NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg says he stopped to chat with friends outside his office after the performance.
And so when my father returned to gather up his beloved Stradivarius, his musical dancing partner, as he put it, of 30-some-odd years, was gone.
For Roman Totenberg, it was like losing an arm. The brazen theft made international headlines. Only an estimated 600 Stradivarius violins still exist. Nina says her father's robbery case remained cold for decades.
And he used to say, when people would say, "Professor Totenberg, do you think your violin will ever be found?" And he would say, "After I have kicked the bucket."
Sadly, he was right about that, and about the culprit. The lifted Strad reappeared in 2015, 3 years after Roman Totenberg died at the age of 101.
The thief was the person my father always thought it was, a guy named Philip Johnson, who was an aspiring musician. He was not a student of my father's, but I think his ex-girlfriend was. And my dad was just very suspicious of him.
After Johnson died in 2011, his ex-wife found a locked crate, and inside it, a beautiful violin. Appraisers and the FBI determined it was Totenberg's. His daughters were ecstatic, but what they wanted most was to find a new, passionate, and compatible partner for the violin.
We wanted to make sure it was going to be played in great concert halls around the world, where my father played it until it was stolen.
In the end, the Totenbergs sold the Strad to an anonymous buyer. The new owner handed it to a new consortium he dreamed up that would loan exquisite string instruments to young, rising musicians. This is 19-year-old Juilliard student Nathan Meltzer playing the storied violin. He's been performing some of Roman Totenberg's favorite pieces, including Bartok's Rhapsody No. 1 for violin and piano. It's on the program tonight at a homecoming recital at Longy School of Music.
The very same hall, which is great and inspiring and also slightly frightening.
Over the past year, the musician's been discovering the violin's masculine, silky vocal qualities, along with imprints he feels Totenberg left after playing it for so long.
It's such a dark and resonant instrument, and the way it sounds like he approached his way of phrasing and his general musical voice is a very, very soulful one.
The Totenberg sisters have been sharing stories, videos, and recordings with Meltzer, including their father playing Franck's violin sonata in the 1950s. For Meltzer, when the music turns angsty, it evokes the deep heartbreak Totenberg felt after his Strad was stolen. Meltzer wanted to play this at tonight's performance, in part because the final movement brings a celebratory release of tension. He says it connects to the relief so many people feel now that Roman Totenberg's Strad is back in action. Here's Meltzer playing that part on the famous violin. Nina Totenberg looks forward to seeing Meltzer, her family, and her father's friends at a place where this once-lost violin's journey can come full circle.
It really does bring tears to my eyes every time I think of returning to the scene of the crime and making a happy occasion out of it.
Nina knows there won't be dry eyes among the Totenberg sisters, but there will be plenty of watchful ones, the new violin guardians included.
I'm not going backstage unless I have the violin in my hand.
For Here and Now, I'm Andrea Shea.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.